WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Heather Bosch.
There have been 14,000 threats against members of Congress just this calendar year.
And Republican Senator James Lankford tells CBS's Face the Nation concerns are only growing after a political influencer was shot dead at an event in Utah last week. CBS's Christian Benavidez.
CBS News has learned the Trump administration is sending a $58 million request to Congress to increase security for members of the executive and judicial branches in light of the assassination of conservative political activist Charlie Kirk.
The president says he also supports increasing congressional security. FBI Director Kash Patel is facing questions about his handling of the Kirk investigation. CBS's Scott McFarlane explains.
The grades are incomplete right now. It was the father who seems to have turned in his son in this case, and the FBI director was caught with some social media posts that were conflicting with other information, saying a subject was in custody, then a subject was released. And the FBI director also posted this weekend, against all law enforcement recommendations, we released that video of the suspect. The governor of Utah today said, we certainly never recommended against releasing video. So there's some questions to answer for the FBI as this week begins.
Investigators say after seeing photos of the 22-year-old suspect, Tyler Robinson, his father helped urge Robinson to turn himself in. Kirk is being remembered in France.
American conservateur Charlie Kirk, dont je salue la mémoire aujourd'hui.
That's the convention of the country's far-right National Rally Party. To Israel, where Linda Gradstein reports U.S. Secretary Marco Rubio had a high-level meeting.
Marco Rubio and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu toured the Western Wall, the remains of the ancient Jewish temple in Jerusalem, as well as excavated tunnels nearby. Netanyahu said that Rubio's visit to Israel is a testament to the durability and the strength of the U.S.-Israel alliance. Before arriving in Israel, Rubio said he will be seeking answers from Israel on the way forward in Gaza.
A fourth round of talks between the U.S. and China resumed today in Madrid. More from CBS's Christopher Cruz.
The Treasury Department says the talks are focusing on, quote, national security, economic and trade issues of mutual interest, including TikTok, and cooperating on money laundering networks. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is leading the American delegation. The talks are expected to last until Wednesday.
Word that songwriter Bobby Hart has died. So bad for little Anthony and the Imperials. He also wrote hits for the Monkees. Hart was 86. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. Experts are warning that active clubs, those white nationalist groups disguised as fitness and brotherhood organizations, are spreading rapidly in Wisconsin and nationally. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Experts say they're seeing a rise in white nationalist movements in Wisconsin and across the country that are disguising themselves as fitness groups. They're called active clubs and present themselves as sporting clubs or fighting clubs focused on brotherhood. Art Gibson, professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Dayton, says they recruit both online and in person, targeting young white men using shared interests as tools to gradually introduce and normalize racist ideologies.
Add to that the willingness to engage in violence against people of color, LGBTQ people. There's a clear potential for violence here.
Gibson says active clubs often meet in Christian churches and gyms, with recent activity showing multi-state coordination, like a Wisconsin active club regularly meeting with an Illinois active club for family days. They use distinctive symbols like the Celtic cross, a well-known neo-Nazi symbol, and share content across social media platforms to maintain connections between chapters and other white supremacists. supremacist groups. Gypsum says the groups are a huge shift in organizing for white supremacists and white nationalists following what he calls a decentralized leaderless resistance. Gypsum says new chapters of active clubs are frequently being created and linking with one another. Members say they are dedicated to self-improvement and brotherhood, seeing themselves as a noble resistance in the cause of preserving the white race. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Find more news anytime at civicmedia.us.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly sunny, mid-80s for this afternoon with southeast winds on the light side, 5 to 10. Tonight, a few clouds around the area, lows in the mid-60s. Monday, more clouds on the way. Could see some showers and storms in the afternoon. Highs in the mid-80s. It's 75 at our studios.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend news and sports headlines and discuss Suicide Awareness Month and why the rates keep going up in the state of Wisconsin. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for The Todd Alba Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, analyzing, discussing, reviewing all things rule of law related, justice related, and yes, courts related. A lot of focus on that in this edition of Amicus, a law review. You can be a part of our discussion at 855-752-4842. We'll get to at least one caller, if not more, in this hour. Talking right now about the continued fraying inside the judiciary of understanding is about what the Supreme Court means when it fails to provide information, description, explanation of what it's doing on this emergency docket and the consequences of that, not only for the litigants who don't know what they mean, but now also the lower court judges, including Judge Young of the Federal District Court in Massachusetts and others. Talking right before the top of the hour break about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Fourth Circuit, again, a number of judges. These are appellate court judges right below the Supreme Court. Talking about how the Supreme Court is leaving us in limbo. The case in front of them this past week for oral argument having to do with Elon Musk's access to Social Security data, which stunningly the Supreme Court permitted the Musk team to have, again, without oral argument, without briefing, and simply a one-sentence order permitting them to go ahead to do the work that they've got to do. And as a result of the continuing litigation before the Fourth Circuit, the judges, including Judge James Wynn, saying, "We're out here flailing." He says, "I'm not criticizing you, but you've got to tell us what to do." He says they cannot, they meaning the Supreme Court, cannot get amnesia in the future because they didn't write an opinion on it. He says, "Write an opinion. We need to understand," he says, "why you did it. We judges would just love to hear your reasoning as to why you rule that way. It makes our job easier. We will follow the law," he says. "We will follow the Supreme Court, but we'd like to know what it is we are following." Wow. Wow. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, we have talked about him a lot before. He's the one who issued this major opus on the rule of law in the early part of the 21st century, having to do with affirming the lower court, Judge Zinnes, when it came to her administration of that Abrego-Garcia case. He said, "The Supreme Court's action must mean something. It doesn't do these things just for the kicks of it. Supreme Court, again, has got to tell us what it means." The Fourth Circuit judges are calling upon the Supreme Court to do its job. This is not just me talking. This is not just litigants talking. These are now appeals court judges. These are district court judges, including Judge Young in Massachusetts, in the First Circuit, complaining about what's going on in the rule of law in America. And there is more. In a ruling just last week in another high-profile case, we've talked about this as well. This is the Trump administration targeting Harvard University, those research grants. U.S. District Court Judge Allison Burroughs, we've talked about her a lot, we've heard from her a lot, said that a series of high court rulings on the administration's efforts to end various government grants, quote, have not been models of clarity. Once again, a wild understatement. She says, and they've left many issues unresolved. She adds that sometimes those rulings appear to shift the law without much explanation or consensus. They appear to shift the law without explanation or consensus. And that brings us back again to Judge Frimpong and what the Supreme Court did just less than a week ago in changing the law with respect to detentions and arrests on the streets of America, causing not just confusion, but complete bewilderment about what now law enforcement is supposed to do, not just in Los Angeles, but around the country, in Wisconsin, in Arizona, in Florida, in Louisiana, in Maine, you name it, wherever you are. And Judge Burroughs saying that you're leaving issues unresolved, not telling us what the law is without explanation. Judge Frimpong got it right. Judge Young got it right. And I would offer to you that as we think about what's going on in America, again, this internal dissolution, if you will, of the rule of law inside, not outside the federal judiciary, judges internal to the system complaining about what the nine or at least six of the nine justices are doing. All of that a reflection of where the judiciary is in America today. We know that there are three judges, justices on the Supreme Court who are also complaining about that. We know that Justice Elena Kagan, as we reported here on this broadcast earlier, said this. She said, I think as we have done more and more on this emergency docket, there becomes a responsibility that we didn't recognize when we first started down this road to explain things better. I think we should hold ourselves sort of out on both sides to a standard of explaining why we're doing what we're doing. She goes on to say that even two or three pages of explanation would be helpful, more than just one sentence, right, Elena Kagan? To just sort of say, here's the basic issue, the basic problem that we see, go fix it. That's a sitting Supreme Court justice. And she is joined, of course, by Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor, and even very much around the edges a little bit. You've got Amy Coney Barrett at least acknowledging the nature of the problem while also defending the practice in her recent book. There is a problem in America, and we need to let those judges and justices who are standing strong against this procedural thing that is, I know, it's a lot, and it's very wonky, and it's very down the rabbit's hole, and it's very academic. I understand that completely. It's very law schoolish. But it is important because the world is changing, the nation is changing, based upon the use of this procedural mechanism that has not been used before at the level that's been used now. During the Bush and Obama administration, 16 years. It was invoked 8 times. The Supreme Court granted emergency applications 4 times. In Donald Trump's first term, 40 applications. In the first 8 months of his term right now, he's applied for it 23 times and been granted in most of those. And our justice system is failing because of that. Judges don't know what the Supreme Court means, and we don't know what it means either. Write to Judge William Young, William G. Young, Federal District Court in Massachusetts. Write to Maime, M-A-A-M-E-E, Frimpong, F-R-I-M-P-O-N-G. She's a U.S. District Court judge in the Central District of California. That's Los Angeles. And let them know that you appreciate their writings. We appreciate the fact that Judge Young, 50 years on the bench, senior judge now, doing all of this work, still at the age of 84, doing all this work, tell him that we appreciate the work that he's doing. And while we appreciate, and we do appreciate, and we embrace his apology, which he didn't have to do, to the justices, the reality is he's apologizing for something that's not his error. And that's exactly what former Justice Stephen Breyer is saying in admonishing his former colleagues for attacking Judge Young. Following all of that drama at the Supreme Court level, it's a lot. It's a lot. And it's also reflective of what the Supreme Court is doing today. And it is, I would offer in part, the reason why the Supreme Court's overall sense of integrity and reputation and cohesion and coherence and descriptive clarity has been compromised. A year ago, we were talking about ethics issues. Now we've got this. Chief Justice John Roberts, you've got to do something to address these issues. Follow what Justice Elena Kagan and others are saying and drop this practice. Or if you need more time, do that. We'll give you more time, all of us will, to issue those major opinions. Or simply say, you know what? Let the litigation go ahead in Los Angeles and in Boston and other places. We'll take it up as we normally do on the merits docket. We'll resolve these cases when they come up. Eventually, we don't have to be entering all of these emergency applications because they're truly not emergencies. Say that, Chief Justice John Roberts, and clean this up for all of us. That's the encouragement today on Amicus Law Review. As a part of this, of course, we continue to recognize that lower courts continue to do a lot of work both in our nation and, yes, indeed, in other nations. Let's do some rule of law snapshots before turning to First Amendment and Second Amendment issues in the wake of the violence in our nation of just this past week. Let's go to Brazil. Brazil's former president, you know, we've talked about him before, Jair Bolsonaro, sentenced to more than 27 years in prison late this past week for overseeing what? Described this before, that failed coup. He's charged under the rule of law system there for a plot, a failed plot, much like our own here in the last days of the Trump administration, the first Trump term, of losing the 2022 elections there. It is a landmark ruling for Latin America's largest nation. Bolsonaro convicted of doing what? Orchestrating, does this sound familiar? A conspiracy that included overturning the vote, attempting to affect and dismantle the courts, handing special powers to the military, attempting to assassinate the president-elect who won the election in the end. Bolsonaro has denied doing any of that, but now he's been convicted and he has been sentenced. It's the first time in Brazil, a nation with, of course, a long history of coups. We now have one in our nation as well, an attempted coup, holding him accountable for doing that. Now, realistically, Bolsonaro will, while he's been sentenced to 27 years and 3 months, it's unlikely that he's going to spend that time, will likely be given some commutation because of some health problems. He attributes a lot of those to complications from a stabbing attack on the campaign trail in 2018. Significant that in Brazil, they held a former president responsible for an attempted coup to overthrow a legitimate election, and they sentenced him to prison. He is right now in home arrest, and he is now convicted. The sentence itself can be appealed. The underlying conviction cannot under the Brazilian system. That's number one. Let's talk about some other things that have happened in America, in the courts here as well. Let's talk about what's going on with respect to E. Jean Carroll. An appeals court just this past week upholds E. Jean Carroll's, hold on, as you know, recall this well, $83 million judgment against the current president. His name is Donald Trump. Federal appeals court upholds that judgment for defaming E. Jean Carroll after she accused him of a sexual assault that happened in that Manhattan department store, Bergdorf Goodman, an attack for which he was separately found liable for sexual abuse. All of that remains in place. The appeals court this past week unanimously upholds that underlying judgment, granting her $83 million, predicated upon the sexual abuse, a sexual assault committed by my now current president back in the 1990s, upholding that jury award, finding that that's the amount of money that she is entitled to, not only for reparation, but also to punish him for doing just that. $65 million of that $83 million amount is attributable to punitive damages after the jury, not the court, the jury, a jury of peers found President Trump, based upon this defamation, based upon his physical conduct, that he acted with malice in doing all this. That happens just this past week. It's a defamation case. It is a limit on the First Amendment, and it's significant to note it now because we are going to go, into the coming segments talking more about the First Amendment. This is one of the restrictions on it, is a defamation action. You can't say something about someone that you know is wrong, that is wrong, do it with intent and purpose, and get away with it in America. That is also a part of our understanding. When we come back, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Google. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Seattle Police Department. We're going to take some calls, and we are also then going to talk about what happened this past week at Evergreen High School and Utah Valley University, the First Amendment, Second Amendment implications, all that coming up on Amicus, a law review.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Are you looking for ways to give back to your local community? Use volunteerwisconsin.org to find opportunities to volunteer your time with organizations making a difference near you. As we celebrate United Ways Month, we're also celebrating you. Visit volunteerwisconsin.org or get in touch with your local United Way or Volunteer Center to find out more about local opportunities to get involved. VolunteerWisconsin.org is hosted by United Way of Wisconsin and Serve Wisconsin. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
Does Donald Trump's big bill provide the largest federal spending cut in U.S. history? No. Spending cuts in the bill that Trump signed wouldn't be the largest ever, despite claims by Republican U.S. Representative Scott Fitzgerald. The original House version would have nominally cut over $1.6 trillion over 10 years. The final version cut even less, $1.2 trillion. With $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, the act will increase federal debt by a massive $3.3 trillion over the next decade. Nonpartisan analysts say the plan's cuts would rank behind a 2011 law's $2 trillion in spending cuts. As a percentage of GDP, it doesn't rank in the top 5%. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org, a message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Once again, honored and so very pleased you've chosen to spend some portion of your weekend in discussion and engagement with us on these major issues having to do with government, the administration of justice in our nation and beyond. We have callers. We value your views, your questions, your comments, your observations. Let's get to those right now. Let's begin with Mark, who is calling in from Prairie du Sac. Mark, your comment or question.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, it seems to me that the Supreme Court at least, is violating the principles that are set forth in the Constitution. This arbitrary and capricious nature that they are bringing up now with detentions, I mean, that's what was mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, that giving this powers to ICE to just detain people reminded me, as I texted, is that giving immunity to these people, you know, to whatever crimes they commit. I mean, that, you know, ICE detains somebody and beats on them, and it turns out it's an American citizen. Oh, it's so too bad, so sad. You know, we misjudged the situation. Sorry, we knocked some of your teeth out. But that's just the price of freedom, and it is disgusting that the Supreme Court is doing this. I mean, that anybody could be detained at this point in time. I mean, a Supreme Court justice could be maintained, you know, that an officer could say, I heard him talking to somebody, I thought the guy was a Russian agent, so I arrested him. And it is just, you know, based on just judgment alone, I mean, that the whole principle is there's supposed to be probable cause.
Right. And reasonable suspicion, right, on the street, probable cause to issue a complaint, to indict, all those kinds of things. And, Mark, I think you would find a great comfort, if not a satisfaction, the words, again, of Sonia Sotomayor, along with Kagan and Brown Jackson. She said we should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, appears to work a low-wage job. She once again says, as she always does, in these kinds of dissents in which she is so strongly opposed to what the majority has done, she says, rather than stand idly by while our constitutional freedoms are lost, I dissent. Exactly. And Mark, maybe you're one of those people who should write a letter to Judge Frimpong and tell her, thank you for standing up to the standards of reasonable suspicion on the streets and for ensuring that at least that principle, that concept remains out there as the discussion goes forward. The case there, of course, is not completely resolved. It continues. The Ninth Circuit, again, is still resolving it, as you've implicitly indicated, Mark. Appreciate very much your observations about the history there. And I know you also dropped a comment into our chat box about the Bolsonaro situation and bemoaning the fact, once again, that we have not done here, executing the kind of judgment or justice and resolving the case to judgment that the Brazilians have done in their nation. Mark, appreciate your participation in our discussion this weekend on Amicus Law Review. A couple more rule of law snapshots briefly to bring you up to date. These are the kinds of things that are significant in our world. They do affect our world in two different areas once again. I've spoken in the past about the fact that the United States Department of Justice, at least it used to on a regular basis, would approach police forces around the country with consent decrees, sometimes with litigation, all kinds of mechanisms for ensuring that they are also, as Mark just said, abiding by the basic standards for law enforcement in America. Here's a good news item in the midst of other troubling news. The Seattle Police Department is now concluding 13 years of oversight by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's ending a monitoring period after allegations of excessive force, racial bias in the Seattle Police Department. A federal judge, his name is James Robart, R-O-B-A-R-T, said on Wednesday that the city has complied with his obligations. He lifts the consent decree and the adoption of some use of force policies, body cameras, changing protocols for holding officers accountable, reviewing its crowd management statistics and tactics, all those kinds of things. All of that good news. And the consent decree now dissolved, having produced the result that it should indeed produce. Significant also that it comes from what? The U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, the Special Litigation Section, to go down that road, that used to do these kinds of things. Ask this administration the extent to which it's continuing oversight of our police departments and working toward remedies, not punishment, but remedies to the problems that we sometimes see in our police in America. Here's another case, unrelated. This comes out of the pen of Judge Amit Mehta, M-E-H-T-A. We've talked about him a lot, too. He's in the district court in the District of Columbia. You recall well, he entered that major decision a while back, finding that indeed Google constitutes a monopoly in America with respect to some of its landmark search policies and practices. And just this past week, in a 223-page ruling, he imposes a penalty that's not nearly as dramatic. He doesn't order that Google be broken up. He says instead that Google has to share some of its search data with qualified competitors. And that's what this case was all about, a monopoly with respect to search data. And the Justice Department had asked the court to force the company to share even more data and argued, of course, that because of that, the dominance of Google in this particular area was overwhelming. He put some restrictions as well on Google to ensure that its search engine gets prime placement in web browsers and on smartphones. And so restrictions on that capacity, which also addressed the kinds of things that he found earlier in his monopoly ruling. But he stopped short, once again, of banning those payments entirely and did not grant the government's request that Google be forced to sell Chrome, which all of us know the government said was necessary to remedy the company's power as a search monopoly. The judge said, notwithstanding this power, courts must approach the task of crafting remedies with a healthy dose of humility. This court has done so. That's Judge Amit Mehta just this past week and now bringing to conclusion that major, major monopoly case against Google. When we come back, the somber discussion continues in America when we talk about the tragedies of gun violence. We talk also about the wonderful permissions, but also the limits of First Amendment discussion and debate in America when Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
CBS News Brief. Arrangements are being made to remember Charlie Kirk, who was fatally shot at an event in Utah last week, a friend to President Trump.
He was a really special guy, so I'm going to be going to Charlie's, I guess you'd call it a funeral. There's a small one. I said, can we do the big one? Because we're going to give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is a big deal.
American and Chinese trade talks resumed in Madrid today. The BBC's Tom Bailey.
The most likely outcome from this round of talks is expected to be another extension of a deadline for the social media platform TikTok's Chinese owners to divest its U.S. operations by next week.
If not, TikTok faces a ban in the U.S. Songwriter Bobby Hart has died.
Take the last train.
Hart wrote many hits for the Monkees. He also penned Hurt So Bad for Little Anthony and the Imperials. Hart was 86. CBS News Brief, I'm Heather Bosch.
A big win for the crew. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from American Family Field, where the Brewers came back to win 9-8 last night in 10 innings against the St. Louis Cardinals. So the Brewers won the series, and for the seventh time in 8 years, they are headed back to the postseason. They wrap up their series today against the Cardinals, then travel out west to play the Angels in L.A. Tuesday night. On Friday, they'll be in St. Louis to begin a three-game weekend series against the Cardinals. And then the following Monday, they'll be back home to start a series against the San Diego Padres. College football. The Wisconsin Badgers struggled on offense. Center Jake Renfro had to leave the game with an injury. The next two centers had trouble snapping the ball to quarterback Danny O'Neill. Alabama got rolling and beat the Badgers 38-14.
Well, that's obviously not easy to swallow. And the truth of the matter is, I told those guys that was a much better team than we are right now.
That's the Badgers head coach Luke Fickell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Superman and Lex Luthor teaming up together? What is this world coming to? Before you know it, cats and dogs will be living together. Variety has announced that the sequel for this summer's hit Superman is in motion. If you thought the first one was a spectacle, the follow-up promises an even bigger nemesis will face off against the unlikely duo. James Gunn's Superman, starring David Corenswet, made $613 million worldwide and was a big first swing for the DC Universe, a company where Gunn currently serves as co-CEO. James Gunn says the sequel will be as much a Lex Luthor film as it will be a Superman film. The director says he loved working with Nicholas Holt, who played Luthor, and really identified with the Luthor character. Yikes. A couple other tidbits from Gunn's Superman world. The director says Supergirl, starring Millie Alcock, is on the schedule to be released in 2026. Superman, A Man of Tomorrow, will start filming in 2026 and be released in 2027. For more showbiz fun, tune into Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly cloudy tonight, mid-60s. Slight chance of a thunderstorm on your Monday, otherwise partly sunny, and highs around 84. For Monday night, clouds and 69. Tuesday, mostly sunny, highs near 86. Wednesday, scattered storms and a high around 83.
It's 76 at our studios.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Joe Zepecki.
As much as I disagree with Charlie Kirk, no American should ever face physical violence for what they believe. And maybe that's how we get past it and move forward, is just say, this is not about we can't get to a period of political violence. We're in one, and now we got to get out of it. And we have to recognize each other's humanity.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, Robert Craig from Citizen Action on healthcare cuts and Jocasta Zamarripa, candidate for Wisconsin Secretary of State.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We're going to be spending the next two segments of our weekend broadcast talking about the tragic events once again in American history of just this past week, the tragic, catastrophic event at Utah Valley University, the no less catastrophic event at the Evergreen High School, and other catastrophic events around the country on a regular basis involving firearms and the taking of lives. I'm going to begin, however, in talking about the First Amendment and freedom of expression. Going back to some of the fundamental things we've talked about that the Supreme Court has told us about over time, and hopefully providing some perspective, as we sometimes do here on Amicus Law Review, some law school instruction, some civics instruction about what the dimensions of our constitutional rights are, freedom of expression, capacity and constitutional authority to carry and use weapons. First Amendment and Second Amendment issues now looming large here on our broadcast. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America says this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We've talked a lot about that, and the Supreme Court again continues to focus a lot of our attention on religious issues, establishment clause, free exercise clause, or abridging the freedom of speech, and there it is, or of the press, or of the right of people peaceably to assemble or to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's the First Amendment to the Constitution, James Madison. Bill of Rights, ratified effective December 15, 1791, the Second Amendment to the Constitution, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. First Amendment, Second Amendment, the Constitution of the United States of America. Let's provide some insight and perspective about what those means, what those amendments to the Constitution mean, what dimensions they have, what limits they have. And I will begin by indicating, as I often do, that there is no right in America, no right in our nation, no right in the Constitution that is unconditional. And so when you hear someone say, I have rights, the answer is absolutely you do. And they are established not just for citizens, but for anybody who's here. Residents, they apply across the board. At the same time, there are restrictions and conditions and limitations and all kinds of things that government can and must do permissibly, constitutionally, legally, lawfully, even inside those great commissions of power among people. Let's begin with the First Amendment itself. Again, this notion of freedom of speech. It is a very, very broad concept. And without going into the legal issues that you get in law school and maybe even in your own law classes that you may take outside of law school, you know the fundamentals here, that the First Amendment of the Constitution has been interpret it appropriately to say that what this means is that we will let people in America, as one of our major political candidates said a number of years ago, we'll let you say stupid things. We'll let you say offensive things. We'll let you say things that many people would find offensive. We'll let you say intelligent things. We'll let you say things that are moving our discussion forward. Offensive things, even things that people may recoil at in horror. The First Amendment is broad. And it's the reason why we'll permit you to engage in name calling, which, yes, our president and others do. That is protected by the First Amendment. We give you an incredibly large breadth to do those kinds of things, to say positive things, encouraging things, things that promote our national discussion in a way that is productive. And yes, also to say things that may not be productive and to which you may take great objection. And we let you also assemble in places that may in fact seem offensive. It's the reason why we let the KKK demonstrate in Skokie, Illinois, with a large Jewish population. It's the reason why we let certain churches demonstrate in opposition when there are memorial services for members of our LGBTQ community. It is offensive to many of us, if should be to all of us, but we let that happen because that is the breadth and the scope of the First Amendment, and we embrace that, even in the wake, obviously, of the violence, especially at Utah Valley University involving Charlie Kirk just this past week. We may not agree with the things he and others say, but we embrace, as we all do in these post-catastrophic event assessments, we embrace the capacity and the right to say those things. Offensive, supportive, objectionable, favorable. All of that is a part of the First Amendment. It is not, however, in the same breath, it is not, however, without its limitations. Name the right in America. Name the constitutional right. Identify the article of the Constitution in the Bill of Rights in any aspect of our Constitution, and you can identify as well the restriction on it. What are the restrictions with respect to the First Amendment that has this broad breath for both people and also, yes, the media? New York Times versus Sullivan, a huge amount of authority in the media with respect to public figures to get it wrong from time to time and can only be found liable civilly if there is actual malice. That, too, is a part of the way that we reflect upon the First Amendment as being very broad in its dimension. It has its limits. And yes, indeed, the government, the Congress, as the authors of the First Amendment indicate, and by the way, Congress interpreted to mean government generally at all levels ever since 1791. The government can indeed impose what? Time, place, and circumstance trappings of expressions of the First Amendment, limitations on it. The government can indeed establish prohibitions and restrictions, conditions on the timing of your expression of your beliefs, whatever they may be. That can include things like the time of day. It can include things like the places. Yes, indeed, common places like parks and sidewalks, those are generally permissible. The government can indeed request and require that you get a permit as a way of exercising that right. Time, place, and circumstances of the ways in which you express those rights can be limited by the government. Why all of these restrictions on rights? It is because we live in a society of people where we care about each other, and there are necessary restrictions on the individual liberties that all of us have, including the right to speak one's mind. Whatever those statements may be, government can indeed limit them as to time, place, and other circumstances, because we live in a society and the greater good is promoted by those limitations. Can there be debates about those? Absolutely. That's why we go to court all the time. That's why you may petition your local schools and your local city ordinances and as they are enforced by municipal entities. And yes, even county officials and state officials and certainly federal officials. We do that all the time. We have disagreements about the ways in which those restrictions can be applied. And that, too, is a part of the system. There is another restriction There's another understanding that goes along with that, and that while the government can impose those kinds of time, place, circumstances, restrictions that, among other things, for example, do not give you the right to come onto my personal private property at 2 o'clock in the morning with an assembly of 20 people with a large amplification system and play music very loudly, that is probably not permissible. Almost certainly is not. Why? You may be able to do that in other circumstances, maybe not on private property, but other circumstances, all of that having to do with conditions on the expression of your free speech. There is one that also is significant in this area, and that is that government cannot, even though it can restrict those kinds of things based upon the ways in which the communication is conveyed. It can't restrict it based upon content. I cannot say, if I am a municipal authority, if I'm a governmental authority, that everything is right about your timing and your place and the other trappings of your expression, but I don't like the content of what you're saying. Whatever government does with respect to restrictions, they've got to be content neutral. That's the catchphrase. That's what the Supreme Court has said that government cannot do. They cannot say that because we do not like what you're saying on any issues, and you can fill in the blank. Whatever it is that divides us as a nation, that brings us together as a nation, many controversial issues out there, you have a right to espouse those as long as the government does not restrict them based upon content neutrality. Other things, yes, indeed. And then there is another one that we have seen in recent times, and that is a restriction that goes beyond just simple statements and even advocacy about positions that may be positive and negative, that may be attractive and may be completely offensive. There is another limitation on all of that, and that is incitement to violence. If in my expression of hatred, if in my name calling, if in the other things that I do that are obstructionist and are offensive and are somehow contrary to who we believe we are as Americans, even permitting that, if I take the next step and I advocate that certain people be killed, injured, that property be destroyed, that destructive forces be undertaken, all of that is beyond the scope, beyond the pale, beyond the protection of the First Amendment. You do not have a right. It is a limitation on the right on the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of advocacy, freedom of assembly. You do not have the right to advocate for violence. That you cannot do. And indeed, if you do that, you may find yourself running afoul of federal law and state law, criminal law, indeed, beyond just ordinance violations. You may also find yourself in violation of, as E. Jean Carroll has shown us, as we talked just moments ago, if in fact you defame someone, that may not be violent. It may be verbally, linguistically violent. If you say something about someone in America and it is not true, and you know that it's not true, you do it with malice and with purpose, and you say that out loud to the damage, to the harm of that person, you have just committed what E. Jean Carroll has taught us in America, which is defamation. And our president recently has had the defamation judgment against him affirmed by the Federal Appeals Court, $83 million, as we reported just recently. There are limitations on the First Amendment right to free speech. Defamation is one of them. That's a civil proceeding. And incitement, inducement, encouragement to violence, that is another. I know that many of you are probably thinking, well, gee, what about January 6th? And obviously, the current president, was ultimately indicted for conduct related to that event on that day, before and after it as well. You know what happened in that case, brought by the special counsel, Jack Smith. He did not, interestingly, charge that case based upon violations of the First Amendment. He charged it based upon other things that allegedly Donald Trump did in and about that time that caused the events on Capitol Hill of that day. It was not brought intentionally as a First Amendment case. And he chose to do that specifically because, frankly, He is a very good and very thoughtful, very professional, and very wise litigant when it comes to representing your interests. The First Amendment has all kinds of limitations on it, and those are them. When we come back, we'll talk about the Second Amendment as also animating our discussion this day, this week, this time in the United States of America here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Hunters, beware what you eat. Wisconsin health officials have issued a new consumption advisory for ducks harvested on Green Bay. Testing shows mallard and wood ducks on the bay are contaminated with toxic PFAS forever chemicals. UW-Madison researchers have linked contamination in the bay to Tyco Fire Products near Marinette. A key research center on the Mississippi River is falling prey to big federal cuts targeting science. The French Island facility, known as an ecosystem research area, produces information on water quality, invasive species, wildlife diseases, and more. Heavy cuts to the program take effect on October 1st and could effectively eliminate more than a century of scientific research. Knowledge is power. Right now on the Defender podcast, $150 million is available to help Wisconsinites upgrade their homes and cut energy use. Learn how to get started at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Chuck Collins. I'm the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer and a member of the Patriotic Millionaires. I'm also the author of a new book, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. This summer proved to all of us that climate change is real and it is deadly. And I'm here to tell you that a small group of billionaires are making it worse. Did you know that billionaire Jeff Bezos' wife, Lauren Sanchez, emitted more carbon in her 11-minute Blue Origin space flight than the average person emits in a lifetime? Did you know that the average super yacht produces as much carbon emissions as 1,500 regular vehicles? And that private jets emit 10 to 20 times more pollutants per passenger than commercial airplanes? So who should pay for climate change? People like you who recycle and turn off the lights when you leave the room, or billionaires who take joyrides in space? Tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. I'm Chuck Collins. I'm a patriotic millionaire, and I approve this message.
Amicus, a Law Review with Jim Santel.
Louisiana versus Calais, C-A-L-L-A-I-S, could deal a death blow to the impact, the power, the capacity of the Supreme Court to decide Voting Rights Act cases. This is one of those times when the Supreme Court needs to hear from the public about the appropriate resolution of this major case that could compromise the Voting Rights Act going forward beyond Louisiana.
Amicus, a Law Review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11. The Maggie Dawn Show.
James Santel joining me. Donald Trump just flat out threatening Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
A lot of people apparently, Maggie, in high places in government engaging in mortgage fraud, including Adam Schiff and Letitia James, and now Commissioner Cook as well. The Federal Reserve is created independent of politics, preventing exactly this kind of thing from happening. This is the instability that causes economic crisis.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, spending some time in instruction, in law school, civics, insight into the events of this past week, having to do with free speech and a lot of the discussion, the debate going on in the wake of the assassination, the horrific, catastrophic assassination of Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University, the injuring of students at Evergreen High School, all of that on the same day. We know as well that there are mass shootings, more than 300 in our nation, even up to this point. We know about not only the impact of firearms upon our nation, but also on individuals. Beyond our First Amendment discussion of the previous segment, again, that all about the fact that we do in this nation embrace free speech, even to protect unpopular and hurtful ideas, to allow open discussion and participation in democracy. There are limitations on that, and those limitations, incitement to violence, defamation, and yes, other things like obscenity and fraud and child pornography and true threats and things called fighting words. There are limitations on First Amendment rights, which should also animate our discussions and our debates in the wake of the catastrophic events of this past week. Also should animate our discussion and our debates about firearms in America. We know, again, the Second Amendment has been interpreted a mere 17 years ago, since 2008, to include the absolute right, conditioned, however, upon limitations to possess firearms in America. Those of you who are 18 years or older have lived in a time in America when the Second Amendment was not interpreted, was not understood to vest in you a personal liberty, a personal constitutional right to possess firearms. That happened in 2008 in a case called Heller versus D.C. We've talked a lot about it on this broadcast. Antonin Scalia found for the first time in our nation's history that the Second Amendment can and should be interpreted to include the right, the constitutional right, to possess weapons, in particular a handgun, in the home for the purpose of self-defense. And just a few years ago, 2023, in a case called Bruin, written this time by Clarence Thomas, embracing that same concept and expanding it to places beyond the home. Between Heller and Bruin, they do in fact establish rights to possess and own and use firearms in America. Absolutely. But like the First Amendment, it is restricted. And here's the point. It is not without condition. If someone says to you, I have an absolute Second Amendment right to do whatever I want to do with guns, just like someone who says, I have an absolute right to say whatever I want, they are wrong about that. The Second Amendment, like the First Amendment, is conditioned. And believe it or not, Antonin Scalia himself established what those conditions are. Take a look at Heller. Take a look at what the Supreme Court said 17 years ago. Said nothing about our opinion that establishes this right prevents government, the Congress and government, any municipal authority, any county authority, any state authority, any federal authority from imposing restrictions on it. And what are those restrictions? The circumstances of manufacture and distribution and sale and packaging and transfer and use and timing, all those kinds of things can, in fact, legally, constitutionally be imposed by government. No right without its conditions. And who said that? Antonin Scalia said that. And yes, indeed, in Bruin, just a few years ago, 2023, that basic concept that the Second Amendment right to possess and use weapons in America is restricted by certain conditions and terms and conditions reaffirmed by the Bruin court, especially John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh in their concurrences in Bruin, affirm just that. You can indeed legally, constitutionally impose limitations on the rights to possess, to use, to transfer, to sell weapons in America. And that's why the legislation that, for example, imposes a cessation of the gun show loophole, that requires universal background checks, that bans assault weapons, which we had in this nation for 10 years, a number of decades ago, that provides for safe gun storage, that establishes, for example, an extreme risk protection order that says if you see someone in your family who, because of a mental illness or other concern, may be a threat to themselves or some other people, you can go into court and have a judge temporarily, upon a finding, factual presentations, make a determination that that person should no longer have a firearm for a limited purpose. All of those kinds of things are legal, and they are constitutional, and they are being done in states across the union. And we know in those states, including our own United States, that had an assault weapons ban for many years, it works. All those things work. And they are proper and they can be done in America because they're within the legitimate restrictions of the Second Amendment. Restrictions on the First Amendment, restrictions on the Second Amendment. Once again, why? Because we live in an America with 343 million people. We do not live alone. We live in a place and a time that government can indeed impose time, place, and manner restrictions on the freedom of speech. And yes, there are limitations on the things that you can say in the areas of incitement and defamation and obscenity and child pornography and others. And yes, there are limitations on your capacity to use and carry and transfer and sell firearms in America as well. And Congress and legislatures around the country can impose those legally and lawfully. The courts find that all the time. And so as we think about the horrific things that have happened once again in America, we think also that's 416 days from now, from today, that we go to the polls on November 3rd of 2026, and we vote for our federal representatives who have the capacity when it comes to the Second Amendment to impose those kinds of rational, reasonable restrictions that will keep us safe and secure, not just in 2026, but going forward. That is what American democracy is all about. That is what a republic is all about. Representative democracy that is brought together to encourage the safety and security and well-being of the United States of America. That was the vision of our founding fathers. I encourage us all to think about all of that as we continue the debates in America that will certainly go on. And I encourage you to come back again next week as we'll continue our discussion of the rule of law and government and justice in America here on Amicus, a Law Review. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Heather Bosch. Investigators are working to determine the exact motive of the 22-year-old man in custody who's accused of fatally shooting conservative activist Charlie Kirk at an event in Utah last week. Governor Spencer Cox.
Official charges will be filed on Tuesday, and there will be much more evidence and information available then.
More from CBS's Scott McFarland.
The governor says multiple people are talking here, including the roommate of the suspect, who he describes as incredibly cooperative. The roommate, he says, had no idea this was happening, and he also says the roommate may have been in a romantic relationship with Tyler Robinson, may have been gender transitioning, but the governor says there's no indication or no idea yet if that's at all relevant to this case.
Was the killing politically motivated? CBS's Christopher Cruz says that question has politicians on both sides of the aisle concerned.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford said